We're set. Hi guys, welcome to our podcast entitled Civil Disobedience or Religious Fanaticism, Sophocles' Antigone and Camilla Shamsie's Home Fire. I am Marla McCraney and I'm studying Classics, Computer Science, and History at Birmingham Southern College.
And my name is Claire Lassar. I am an art major and classics studier at Birmingham Southern as well.
I'm Ellie Schaefer. I'm studying psychology, sociology, and women's studies at BSE.
And today we will be talking about burial rights as they relate to civil law and natural law.
So you may be wondering how this pertains to you. And before we started researching this, I had no idea that there were stories today that
pertain to burial rights.
Yeah. So on April 15th in 2013, you guys know this story. Two bombs went off near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Three people were killed and nearly 300 were injured. Brothers Tamerlan and Joe Saraniah were soon found to be the men that carried out these vicious attacks. After a manhunt all over Boston, the older brother was killed by the police, and the younger brother was found hiding out in a civilian's backyard and was placed under arrest.
Once Tamerlan was killed by police, they stumbled into another issue: what to do with the terrorist's body. Nobody wanted his body buried near them because of what he had done. And I sure know I would not want him buried near me or near my dead relatives. That just kind of freaks me out.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
He died on April 19th, and it took more than 2 weeks to find a grave for his body.
Yeah.
And it kind of turned into this, like, musical cemeteries thing.
Yeah, and protesters were saying things like, you know, bury this terrorist on U.S. soil and we will unbury him, and it's a disgrace. We don't want a bomber buried in our cemetery. The funeral director in Massachusetts voluntarily became in charge of his body. And finally, an anonymous individual provided the secret spot for his body to lay.
And this provokes a question of, why was it so difficult to find a burial spot for this man's body?
Why do I find it so difficult to allow his dead body to lay next to, like, my dead relative's body?
We know it's terrible what he did, but does that mean he shouldn't be buried?
Does that mean his cold body should lay in a hospital morgue for weeks? He was a human, and he had a life, but while he made a decision, a terrible decision, his body is now dead. It is bones. It can no longer hurt anyone. Does his family not deserve a funeral to remember him as a happy child?
Where do we ethically draw the line of knowing that someone did something terrible during their lifetime, but not providing them or their family a proper burial?
So in Sophocles' Antigone and Camilla Shamsie's Home Fire, the characters wrangle with the limits of civil law as they defend natural law, specifically burial rights for their brothers. At what point do we deny an individual the law of ethics in exchange for the laws of the state? What do we do when individuals who betray their countries, families, and friends die in the name of fanaticism? For clarification, the laws of ethics are those that extend beyond those of society. The laws of ethics or natural laws are applicable in any religion, government, or time period. They differ from the laws of the state, or civil law, because they are not confined to any specific group of people.
The story of Antigone discusses the fundamentals of natural law, drawing on how the identity of the individual becomes a determining factor in whether or not the dead receive ethical treatment in the burial processes. The treatment of the corpse of a terrorist, such as Antigone's brother, shows how natural law and civil law interact, proving that when civil law dictates, there always lurks a possibility of injustice, as civil law tends to override natural law.
Sophocles' Antigone reveals the aftermath of an ill-fated fight to the death between two sons, Polynices and Eteocles, brothers to Antigone and Ismene. Both find themselves power-hungry for the throne of Thebes that was left to them by their father. Their father, Oedipus, who, if you don't know, was kind of crazy. He impregnated his mother, and he didn't know that it was his mother, and it kind of, like, spiraled into this really wild situation. But yes, they were bred.
Story for another time.
Yeah, they were bred from incest. You should know that. But yeah, so he intended that the brothers share the throne by switching off years. but Eteocles was given the first year of their throne share and refused to surrender the crown to Polynices, the rightful ruler of the second year.
So Polynices then plots a rather unsuccessful attack on Thebes, and both him and his brother die in combat. Creon, their uncle, who becomes ruler of Thebes afterwards, declares Eteocles to have full rights to a proper burial, blaming Polynices for the warfare and destruction that ultimately refused his burial rights.
The injustice of not being allowed to bury both their brothers forces Antigone to defy the civil law in order to stand up for what she believes is right. After she buries Polynices, she is caught and locked away in prison by Creon. Creon's like not a good dude.
He's not a good dude.
But also when we get into Camilla Shamsie's story, Homefire, we will see a comparison analysis of
another character who's supposed to represent Creon, and you actually see why these rulers act the way that they do.
And she's brilliant with her writing because she kind of makes you understand why he acts the way he does.
Yeah, you feel empathy towards this character that you previously would not have felt empathy towards.
Yeah, so here Creon's son and Antigone's fiance, called Haemon, finds Antigone to have killed herself. Haemon attempts to stab his father, but he ends up just stabbing himself to death.
The story of Homefire, on the other hand, is set in modern day, centering around London in combination with a few locations in the United States and several scattered across the Middle East. The Pasha family consists of three siblings, Isma, Anika, and Parveh, who are orphaned at a young age. The two younger twins, Anika and Parveh, are raised by their older sister Isma after the death of their mother and grandmother.
They grew up fatherless after their dad left Britain to join a jihadist group. Parveh ends up leaving Britain to follow in his father's footsteps, only to realize that it was a mistake. He tries to escape ISIS and is shot in front of the British embassy in Istanbul.
Anika struggles to defend her brother's honor after he has died, declaring that he had made a mistake and demanding that he has a proper burial. In this struggle, she ends up dying alongside her partner, Iman.
It's really quite a heartbreaking end to the book, because you become very attached to these characters and you empathize with their storylines, and then it ends tragically.
Yeah, let's take a closer look at the parallels between Antigone and Homefire.
In the beginning of Homefire, Anika finds out that Isma has told the police about their brother's involvement as a jihadist. She feels betrayed by Isma's clear act of alignment with the state.
Would you feel betrayed? You would?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would too.
This prompts Anika to cut out Isma from her life. She says, "I mean it, you betrayed us, both of us. And then you tried to hide it from me. Don't call, don't text, don't send me pictures, don't fly across the ocean and expect me to ever agree to see your face again. We have no sister."
Anika's reaction to Isma's betrayal is similar to that of Antigone's feelings of betrayal when her sister refuses to help her bury her brother, Polynices. The dialogue runs, "Ismene, this disobeying the state is utterly wrong."
Antigone says, "Don't say that or I'll have to hate you. He will hate you too. Just let me go, for I'll not suffer anything so grievous as to rob me of a noble death. Dear sister, my dead are mine, and yours as well as mine. Do what you like, but I will not betray him."
The theme of betrayal heavily permeates both of these storylines as fear and desperation sears through family loyalties.
I personally can relate to the bond between Anika and Pris, because I have a twin as well. It's a bond stronger than one of just regular siblings, and I can say that because we have another sibling as well, who we are definitely extremely close with. But it's not the same as me and my twin sister's bond. Twins are literally in their mother's womb together, birthed together, and then side by side their entire adolescent lives. My twin and I have never spent more than a weekend apart from each other until we left for college.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was weird when it happened.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah. Of course you fight and disagree like any other siblings do at times, but there is an out of this universe bond and unconditional love that twins have for one another. You feel things the other one feels.
In Homefire, Anika elaborates on the bond between twins that you're talking about. She says, "That's my twin. I spent every day the last 6 months sick, worrying about him. Now he wants to come home, but your father's unforgiving, particularly about people like him. So I'm not going to get my brother back, and I really don't know what to do. Half of me is always there wondering if he's alive, or what he's doing, and what he's done. And I'm so tired of it. I want to be here completely with you."
Furthermore, Anika's dialogue with Keremat Lone parallels Antigone's dialogue with Creon. The scene between Anika and Keremat Lone begins with a quote from Anika and a reaction by Keremat. She says, To Camerat. In the stories of wicked tyrants, men and women are punished with exile. Bodies are kept from their families, their heads impaled on spikes, their corpses thrown in unmarked graves. All these things happen according to the law, but not according to justice. I am here to ask for justice. I appeal to the Prime Minister. Let me take my brother home. Karamat spun the paperweight on his desk, watched the lion and unicorn animate, and smiled. After all, the noise and spectacle, she was just a silly girl.
So we haven't really gotten into discussing who Karamat is, and he is the father of Eamon, who is
Amika's love interest.
And he's also the Prime Minister of England.
Yeah, and he comes from Muslim descent, so he feels this need to overcompensate for that past and be really hard on terrorism. And so that's where his motivations come from. And yeah. You can see that as you read the book. But it doesn't really go with Anika's dialogue. You can't see it there.
And similarly with how Antigone and Creon interact to Anika and Karamat, Anika declares, Zeus does not...
Antigone declares.
I'm so sorry. Zeus does not, justice does not, what they call law did not begin today or yesterday. When they say law, they do not mean a statue of today or yesterday. They mean the unwritten, unfaltering, unshakable ordinances of the gods, that no human being can ever outrun these laws. These laws live forever. No one knows how they were born or thought I would try transgress them for fear of some mere mortal man's decree. No, of course, I will die, Creon, or no Creon, and death is fine. Death has no pain to leave my mother's son lying out there to be unburied. That would be pain to say this is folly. I say, who knows folly better than a fool?
So here, after that quote you just read, we see the complicated entanglement of what civil war means to justice.
Civil law.
It's okay. In both of these cases, civil law takes precedence over justice as Karamat and Creon disregard the perceived whinings of women. However, Anika and Antigone stand up for their brothers and the natural law of the world. They declare that their brothers deserve to be buried, which is true.
Yeah, I feel similarly. No matter what my brother does, I would definitely want to be able to bury him. And I'm not a twin.
As much as we did discuss the Boston bomber's body being buried, I feel like having that body near me would bother me, even though I feel like they deserve a burial.
Yeah.
So it's been
there's an interesting tension between the two.
Yeah, it's been very conflicting because I feel like the justice of having a burial and like having your family be able to know that your body is put to rest, especially for religious background.
Yeah.
I know it's important for...
Yeah, the burial's for the family, not for the dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
So that's true. By not burying the dead, it's not fair to the family.
Yeah. And they really haven't done anything in most cases. So it's like, why punish the living for what the dead have done?
And
back to the text.
in the story of Antigone and in Homefire, both of the partners of these women, Eamon and Haman, complicate their father's perspectives in hopes of releasing their love interests from the hold of injustice.
And if you remember, Haman is the fiancé of Antigone, and Eamon is also the fiancé of Anika. Ended up getting engaged.
Yeah. In Homefire, Eamon defends Anika, revealing that her true identity and justifying her instincts towards natural law over civil law. Eamon says to his father, Karamat Lone, I do, though, know his sister. The woman you've been watching on your TV screen is a woman who has endured terrible trials, whose country, whose government, and whose fiancé turned away from her in a moment of profound loss. She has been abused for the crime of daring to love, while covering her head, vilified for believing that she has the right to want a life with someone whose history is at odds with hers, denounced for wanting to bury her brother besides her mother, reviled for her completely legal protests against a decision by the Home Secretary that suggests personal animus. So, with this quote, Eamon is pleading with his father to allow Anika's brother to come home.
Yeah. At this point, Eamon has switched sides and is now siding with Anika rather than his father. And at first, he found it kind of difficult to make that transition.
And the only reason his body wasn't allowed home was because of how many people protested having his body buried in Britain. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't think it's their place to feel that way.
It's not their place to feel that way, but also I can see myself feeling that way too.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting
I know, it just breaks conflict. My heart that their family couldn't have that closure.
For sure. And I think that it's more heartbreaking within the framework of Home Fire because you get to know these characters, but with the Boston bomber, I definitely didn't feel any sort of remorse for his family. Just because I didn't have the foundation to even feel that way, I didn't know.
Yeah, and in both Antigone and Home Fire, there's enough context to where you really understand these characters. And especially in Home Fire, you realize that what Parvay was really doing was trying to get home.
Whole time he was really trying to get home. He felt homeless. He didn't have a mother or father or grandmother.
And not having that bond with a father, I'm sure he felt very isolated growing up.
A father who was a jihadist, by the way. You know? So he was following in his father's footsteps, seeking home. And then he died without getting to home. So, similarly, Haemon cries out to Creon in Antigone. Haemon says, "Father, the gods grew minds and men as the most precious equipment they have. Yet I do not know how to say you are wrong. Who knows, it might all turn out fine, but surely my job is to keep a close watch on everything people do or say or want to complain about. Why your dread eye, your displeasure, what people say well? You wouldn't want to hear the kin of things they say, but I can listen from the shadows."
He continues saying, "This girl, through the town, there's grief. They call her wonderful. Most glorious of deeds, most terrible of deaths, they say. She only chose to keep her brother's body from the raw flesh-eating dogs, to keep it from the birds of this sort of talk. I don't know, from the shadow, his father. For I am a son, to be proud of his father, a father proud of his son. What could be better? But please don't be so absolutely single-minded. Whoever imagines he is alone is the one who knows how to think or speak or feel. That man is an empty page. There is nothing shameful in being the person able to learn to be flexible, not too rigid. You've seen the trees bend in a storm, and that's how they save their branches. The stubborn ones get ripped out by the roots, in sailing too. If you haul your sheets taut, you'll capsize the boat. Let go your anger, father. Give a bit. I'm young, yes, but I'm pretty sure of this. No single human being has perfect knowledge. Most of us would be wise now then to take advice."
So both Haemon and Emon serve to further entangle identity with civil and natural law as they justify the actions of their loved ones.
This kind of muddles the water between personal and political. So how does individual desire conflict with what's best for the state? And I think that's perfectly represented in this case.
Yeah, they take the seemingly black and white matter portrayed by Carmat Lone and Creon and muddle the waters. With the explanation of the girls' identities that marry their loyalties to natural law over civil, Haemon and Emon complicate the understanding of what is right and wrong and provide levels of empathy that civil law often fails to recognize, and the parallels don't end here.
Stay tuned, guys.
So, when I was reading Home Fire, I got very emotional at the end. I literally sat in my bed and just kind of closed the book when I'd finished. The last few pages of the book, both Anika and Emon die. They're in a park, and two men approach Emon and lock a belt around his waist. He realizes that the belt is a bomb and shouts out to Anika to get away from him. The following scene takes place, and it's important to note that the man is Emon and the woman is Anika. This is the last scene from the book, told from the perspective of the media during the scene.
A man in a navy blue shirt walks into the park. He is recognized. The journalists race forward. He holds his hand up to them, calls out the name of the woman he's come for. The cameras turn to her. She is the only person unaware, her cheek resting on the lid of ice that has melted to near transparency. The journalists are moved aback, follow a path from him to her. Into this path step two men in beige shalwar kameezes. "At last you're here," says one, and opens his arms wide. The man in the navy blue shirt looks over to the woman, but he's in a new place. He doesn't want to offend. He allows himself to be embraced. while one man pulls him against his chest, pinning his arms in place. The other encircles his waist. The two men step away, turn, run. They're climbing the railings out of the park before the man in the navy blue shirt understands the belt they've locked around him.
He tugs at it. He yells for a knife, something, anything to cut it off. But everyone is running toward this exit or that, screams and voices raised to God. Who else can save them now? One cameraman, a veteran of carnage, stops at the edge of the park beyond the blast radius as well as he can judge, turns his lens into the new emptiness of the field. The woman has stood up now. The man with the explosives around his waist holds up both hands to stop her from coming to him. Run, he shouts. Get away from me. Run. And run she does, crashing right into him, a judder of the camera as the man holding it on his shoulders flinches in expectation of a blast. At first, the man in the navy shirt struggles, but her arms are around him. She whispers something, and he stops. She rests her cheek against his. He drops his head to kiss her shoulder. For a moment, they are two lovers in a park, under an ancient tree, sun-dappled, beautiful, and at peace.
In a heartbreaking twist of events, they both die in each other's arms. Their families are left to deal with the aftermath, much like Creon is left to deal with the fact that he has murdered his child. From Antigone, Creon cries out, "Here is what I did. It was my hard-killing mind. It was my deadly goings wrong. Oh, look, the killers and the killed are all of one family. Oh, my child, too soon dead. The sacrilege that I call public policy. My child, this child, alas, the child, murdered by my own folly." While the entirety of Homefire is rich with parallels to Antigone, these are the main 4 points we had time to discuss.
As I'm sure you've gathered, there is a collective integrity and thematic universality within these texts, as the lessons that arise in Antigone extend beyond that of classical Greece and into modern day.
It is so important to draw connections between antiquity and what is modern day. We can only hope that through this analyzing, that we can bring a new life into the ancient text of Antigone and prompt others to further examine modern texts in the light of antiquity.
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.